Really, we're midway through not just the story, but kind of the battle itself. Gideon has begun the war against the Midianites as directed by God. They have already had what sounds like a crushing victory. God confuses the enemy host. They have all started turning their swords against each other and then really just fleeing for their lives. We'll end up finding the report here in chapter 8 that out of 120,000 men who had begun, or I guess 135 you would have at the beginning, 120,000 of those were gone. So they have just been absolutely decimated. They have been completely wasted by the time we catch up to them again. They have been destroyed, put to flight. Gideon, beginning in verse 24 of the previous chapter, chapter 27, had sent messengers to the men of Ephraim, saying, kind of, we need help with mop-up duty. As we said last week, it's not a foregone conclusion that everything is going to turn out with just total victory, because they do still have a sizable force that they have around them. They still have 15,000 men, the enemy does. And they need to be pursued, they need to be caught, those sorts of things. But Gideon has these Ephraimites come and help him capture some of the Midianite princes or rulers, and they successfully do that. Now, really, in these first several verses of chapter 8, you almost would expect that that's going to be the end of the story. If you didn't have chapter divisions, and so you saw, okay, well, there's a lot left in chapter 8, and you'd not read this before, and you know there's going to be more that happens with Gideon. If you're just going on what we've seen previously in the book, this feels kind of like the end, doesn't it? It feels like, all right, God called his judge, and maybe there were some difficulties, kind of like we started anticipating after Barak didn't want to go at the beginning, so maybe that'll be a theme that we see more and more. But he finally did it. He got these signs from God. He went and did the battle as God directed him to do. Spirit of the Lord came upon him. They drove off the enemy. They even captured the enemy leaders and have killed them. And so after we tie up a few loose ends with this discussion between Gideon and Ephraim, then it'll all be over, right? And we'll get what we anticipate at the end of those stories. The land had rest for such and such years, and then we can, unfortunately, probably start all over again with Israel sinning after those 40 years. But instead, you're going to get this whole chapter, chapter 8, that's going to give us more details. And as we're starting to find out with Judges, we mentioned it before we began the class, the more details we get, the worse things typically are. If he can just tell us a story about somebody that we know hardly anything about, tell us about Othniel, and he just fits into the equation nicely, and he does what God sends him to do, and the land has big rest afterward, that's about as good as it gets. When we start learning more of the colorful stuff about these pictures, that's where the cracks start to show. They're almost never positive details. So these first few verses are Gideon dealing with the men of Ephraim. I am tonight going to kind of follow the questions a little more closely so that I'm not wasting all of your hard work ahead of time and looking at these passages and reading through them. But specifically, we'll find a few interactions with Gideon where he's kind of questioned by somebody, or he has a confrontation of sorts with somebody, and then he has a big speaking role. And so in this first part, what are the men of Ephraim concerned with here? What's the problem that we've got to hash out before we finish up with the Midianites? Okay, a little bit of jealousy on the part of the men of Ephraim. Maybe we'd say, I mean, what at the very bottom line, what seems to be the biggest problem, to me at least? Pride. This is wounded pride. They are the big tribe of Ephraim. We end up finding all of that out later about Ephraim, of course. They become more and more of an important part of Israel, I guess, and seem to have taken that very seriously about themselves. They always thought that they were very important and that they were very powerful, and that, you know, if you were going to do something like this, you should have consulted us. So Gideon did not do that. Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight? It feels less like, you know, we kind of do this sometimes with our friends, with our fellow Christians. If they're going through a problem and you only hear about it later, you might come to him afterward and go, man, I wish you had told me. I wish you had let me know. I could have helped you out. I could have been praying for you, all those sorts of things. And we mean well when we say that. We're just saying, hey, next time, let me know if you need help, okay? And I'll be ready to. That doesn't sound like what Ephraim's doing here. This is wounded pride and saying, you really made a big mistake. Well, how would you grade Gideon's answer? How's he going to deal with this? And how? What are your feelings on what Gideon will say afterward? Yeah, Steve? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Kind of deflects, sort of plays defense and saying, we could talk about that, or we could talk about what a great job you guys did with what you were able to accomplish. And really sort of builds them up. Maybe, we would say, maybe goes a little bit overboard in that. And says, hey, what I've done is nothing to what you've done. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? That's just a way of saying, you know, we don't compare to you in any way. Yeah, Marie. Yes. Again, a recurring theme we'll see from Ephraim. It's going to be just kind of part of their personality. If you couldn't hear Marie, she refers to them doing this again with Jephthah. Later on in chapter 12. Ian, did you? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. In light of the whole chapter, it's almost a strange reaction to me because it will be so totally different from how he's going to deal with Succoth and Penuel. Here is all very soft. Very, very, if we want to look at it in the most positive way, we'd say this is a conciliatory tone. He's embodying the proverb, a soft answer turns away wrath, right? That's what Gideon's doing. He's not turning this into a war with Ephraim, and that's good. But maybe there is a little bit of problem here in that this is a, as some have observed, this is a psychological answer, not a theological one, which maybe we'd feel better if Gideon said, kind of as Steve mentioned, the reason I went to war with the army that I did is because that's who God sent me to war with. He picked the men himself, not even what tribe they were from, individually. He told me, these 300 are your fighters. So I'm sorry that I didn't talk to Ephraim, but I was listening to God. And he doesn't tell them, oh, you know, well, he says, what we did really wasn't that great, right? Gideon's nothing. Your accomplishments were much better. Who's the real hero of this story? We've already seen chapter 7 made so plain. God has given a great deliverance. Maybe we'd like Gideon to say something here like, look, we can debate over who deserves the most credit or who did what, but let's give thanks to God that he has delivered us from our enemies. So go sit down. But none of that happens. This will be a theme throughout several of the final beats of Gideon's life. Maybe there's some good, maybe there's some bad, and I'm not exactly sure which side of that we're meant to fall down on. I'm thinking of this one, though. There's wisdom shown in not producing a bigger fight than there needs to be, but he doesn't really take the opportunities that he could have to have set them straight on exactly why this unfolded the way it did, because it was of God. He mentions there very briefly in verse 3, God has delivered into your hands the princes. But in downplaying his own work, it's almost downplaying God's work. But that crisis seems to be averted for now. Verse 3 at the end, their anger toward him subsided when he said that. But now in verse 4, we've got Gideon in hot pursuit. He and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted but still in pursuit. And they are chasing these you know, straggling survivors from the Midianite host. They will have encounters with two Israelite cities. And this, we're now on the other side of the Jordan. We're now on the east side, but they're still Israelite towns. And he will come to the men of Succoth and Penuel. we can kind of just treat them as one. It's pretty much the same thing happens in both places. He wants supplies, doesn't even ask them to, hey, send all your guys with us, really. It's more just give us some food. We're famished. We need, you know, we got this fight that we need to keep up, and we don't have much strength left. Help us out. And both times, the leaders, the men of the city, refuse to do so. What stands out about the village leaders here and what their approach to this problem? Again, good evaluation, bad evaluation, how much fault do they bear, etc. What do we think of them? Yes. Okay. Again, bear in mind, these are the guys on the east side of the Jordan. If you don't finish up with the Midianites and we back the wrong horse, kind of, then we're the first cities that are going to be feeling their anger, their vengeance, if the Midianites, the Amalekites, the people of the east, if they regroup and come back and start taking our stuff like they've been doing for the last 7 years, we're the ones that are going to bear the brunt of it. So they're saying, give us proof. The literal idea there in verse 6, and it's borne out in the translation, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand. There are attested practices from around this time and place of literally cutting off the hand or the palm of fallen leaders especially, but maybe soldiers, to show, to prove how many you had killed in battle. So they're saying, they're literally saying, show us the proof that you've really finished off their army and their leaders, and then maybe we can talk. But until then, we don't have any reason to help with that. Mike?
Yeah, they didn't ask them to help in the battle.
Yeah.
They kind
of
asked them the least thing that they could have done.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah. Just a cup of cold water, so to speak. I mean, they're kind of asking for the minimum here. Steve? Yeah.
300 men
over this huge army, to begin with, they had to realize that God was with them, so that they had to happen. Okay. If they've heard any report of the battle, Gideon with 300 men has won this incredible victory, and I mean the guys that we're so afraid of are running for their lives right now. Maybe we should be concerned about that and looking into what has happened there to have Steve is pointing out a little bit more faith in that. Maybe this time it is real. Ian? Totally disjointed, totally fragmented. As you've pointed out there, it's everyone looking out for himself. And that's definitely going to come into focus on the most personal level by the end of the story. What's the refrain, jumping ahead quite a bit by now, what's the refrain in those final chapters of Judges, the kind of appendix chapters? Do you remember the theme given to those last few stories? In those days, yeah, there's no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We're already starting to see that's what they've been doing all along, isn't it? That's the sense, the theme of the book of Judges. Everyone's looking out for himself. You don't think it's a good idea to share your bread with somebody? Don't do it. You don't think you want to, you know, jump to one side or the other in a conflict? Well, just wait. If that's not going to help you, don't do it. So, all right, a lot of potential problems here looking forward with Israel fighting against Israel. Israel initially, simply just not helping each other is the primary problem. It will come to actual conflict later. But the problem is this kind of selfishness. And again, this will just be amplified over and over. Here again, with these men, we can say, all right, I understand to a point how they get there. There have been 7 years of agony at the hands of their tormentors. They're going to be the first ones on the chopping block if they are wrong and Gideon loses. On the other hand, we need to have faith. We need to see that God is doing something incredible here. We need to trust in our brethren to do what God has called us to do all along. Kind of balancing all of that is going to be Gideon's response to them, which is that same, to me, that same kind of mix of I understand and I get it, but also hang on a second. We'll get to his response here in just a minute. That even like in verse 4, even details like that are kind of a little bit ambiguous, I guess, when it tells us that Gideon's army was exhausted but still in pursuit, and when it talks about how they're famished men. Maybe we see that as, you know, a positive sign in their favor. They're hungry, they're tired, they're weary, but they're still going to stick with it, right? They're still going to go and finish the job. Or maybe we would compare that with later instances like King Saul, who through his foolish mismanagement and kind of, you know, maniac obsession, tells the army, don't eat anything until we've vanquished our enemies, and has disastrous results from that. And we're meant to see kind of a selfish, obsessive pursuit from Gideon. Again, can sort of be looked at in two ways. But his words to them initially are going to be, well, I'll come back with proof then. We'll revisit this later on. And if I am given the victory that I know will happen, to Gideon's credit, throughout this passage, he will speak with a lot of faith, won't he? We wonder where this guy was in chapter 6 and chapter 7. He says, when the Lord delivers them into my hand, then we'll revisit this and you'll pay for it. Now he seems very certain that victory is his, but he gives them threats of one variety or another, and promises to come back afterward. Sort of just interesting details with both of these conflicts at the beginning of chapter 8. When we met Gideon, he was threshing in the wine press, right? He was threshing grain in the wine press. In chapter 8, the two images that he uses in dealing with these two differing groups, he talks about pressing or making wine with Ephraim, and then he talks about literally threshing the bodies of the elders of Succoth with thorns. And so callbacks again to the beginning of who Gideon was when we met him. Now we're seeing him kind of turning into a different sort of guy. We'll track that throughout the rest of chapter 8. All right, so he leaves, and we'll get back to them in a moment. Beginning in verse 10 then, we have the second part of the battle, sort of the finale of the battle, where Gideon is finally going to pretty much put to rest the enemy army. I ask the question, how would you compare or contrast this one here in verses 10 through 13 with what we saw in the earlier engagement back in chapter 7? What do we see? The same, different? How do these battle accounts stack up with each other? Yeah, Steve? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Very good point. Good strategy. Gideon shows some good, you know, good tactical awareness. It works, obviously. It's effective. We can't say for certain God is not with them, that this is not God working in this case, but the narrator doesn't tell us that. We're not told. God gives them the victory. God told them to do this. God set up how the plan was going to go. In fact, as we've pointed out, after that time where Gideon worships in chapter 7, after he sees and hears the Midianites saying that he's going to win, you don't have any direct activity from God after that point. He'll be referred to. Gideon will invoke his name, But while he was such a fixture of the first part, where Gideon and God are seemingly talking in kind of constant dialogue, after that point, for the whole of chapter 8, you don't hear anything from God. And so he's not really going to be a part of this battle. Anything else jump out? Yeah, Ron. Okay. All right, still pretty long odds. We'd say not nearly the kind of deficit they had in the first case, but it's still 300 against a lot, you know, 15,000. Pretty good outnumbering there. Think of Gideon in all leading up to that first account. He's afraid, and God has to show him these signs, and he's got to say, come on, I'm with you. It's going to be okay. Don't fear. I'll be with you, constantly giving him this affirmation and this motivation. Now, Gideon seems to be over that. He's self-motivated. Remember, his men are famished and weary, but he's still saying, we got to go, we got to go, we got to go. He's pushing them on, and so Gideon is by now self-motivated, definitely. He was fearful in the first case. Now, we're especially going to see this towards the end of chapter 8, seems to be more vengeful. And we'll get back to that idea of fear in a moment. In this account, in chapter 8, it's Gideon himself who captures the leaders. In the other case, it was Ephraim, who actually, maybe we'd say, kind of finishes things, captures the leaders. And the prize, maybe in chapter 7, was a little bit smaller. Those were just referred to as princes. Here they're going to be kings that Gideon is going to capture. So, you know, several differences, maybe highlighting this as a more momentous conflict because it is the final one and maybe the stakes are a little bit higher. But more than anything, we're seeing the growth is maybe almost the wrong word to use, the change in Gideon here up through chapter 8, as he is going on to finish this. Now, I do want to skip over verses 13 through 17 for just a moment. We'll get back to that in a minute. I want to go ahead and finish up with Midian first, which is in verses 18 through 21 of chapter 8. So, these kings that he captures, Zeba and Zalmunna. The fifth question I had on the sheet, if you have one of those. Now we're going to find kind of some last-minute details, almost, that are given that seem to sort of come out of nowhere. This hopefully won't sound like criticism. You know what I mean by saying this. But if you're watching a movie and something like this happened, you'd go, well, that was, why did they do that? All that stuff at the end about the brothers and the thing, that came out of nowhere. There wasn't any way I would have known that was going on. They just started adding these things into the plot here at the very end. I think it serves a purpose. But by now we get to Gideon talking to these captured kings, and he asks them, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? Again, first we're hearing of this, but apparently is some kind of older engagement. And they say, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the sons of a king. And here again, aren't we getting a sense of who Gideon is changing into? It's almost as if to tell us there's been a visual, physical change in him. His bearing is more regal. His bearing is more befitting the mighty warrior, the man of valor that the angel of the Lord called upon back in chapter 6. But they say, essentially, they looked like you, and then add some flattery. And Gideon says, well, yes, they did look like me because they were my brothers. And not half-brothers or something like that. They were the sons of my mother. And so you killed my brothers, prepare to die, is sort of what Gideon delivers here. So he is then going to order his son, his firstborn, to rise and kill them. But he is afraid to do so because he's a youth. And for their part, the two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, they are saying, nah, we'd rather have Gideon too. I like that idea better. He's probably going to finish it more quickly. He's a man of war. We trust him to maybe have one swift stroke. If we have this fearful novice here, who knows how long it's going to take him to kill us, is almost kind of what they seem to have in mind as they're baiting Gideon to do it almost. As a man is, so is his strength, is what they tell him. So Gideon will finish. But my question here, why does this come up in the story at all, and why now? Can we decipher any meaning in giving us this family blood feud that we have being revealed? All right, nobody likes jumping out on those limbs, I know. Steve, go ahead. Okay. Yeah.
And the latter part where the 70 sons are killed, they're not honoring God the way they should have.
Okay.
It's a weakness in not following God, weakness in not following your
father. Okay. So it is, I'm glad Steve pointed this out. I very much think in verse 20 we're supposed to be sort of picturing young Gideon. This is the son following in the early footsteps of his father. Gideon's called by God and said, given essentially the same orders, rise, kill them, go fight the enemy, go kill the Midianites. And Gideon won't take up the sword. He's afraid. I don't want to do it. And that's now his son. You can just sort of transpose his features onto his son. This is him doing the same thing. Maybe this portends some of the weakness that we'll find in this family at large later on in chapter 9. We've kind of talked about it a little bit, but the whole point of this pursuit, this dogged, determined pursuit that Gideon has had with his 300 weary guys who haven't slept all night, they're famished, none of the towns are helping him, they don't have any supplies, but they just have this maniac determination to find and to kill the last dregs of the Midianite army. Now we kind of call into question, why was he so determined in that? Is it because he's Gideon, the faithful judge, called by God, and he's going to do that until the very end? Or has it more all along with this part of the story been, these guys killed my brothers? And it sounds like it is them personally who killed them, not in battle, but as captives. They had time to look at their faces. They had time to know who they were. And so Gideon almost, it seems, has taken them alive for this purpose. The same way we would imagine someone would want to do when you've harmed their relative, you've killed their brother. You want to look them in the eye. You want to let them know that you've caught them, that you've defeated them. And that's what Gideon is able to do here at the end. This maybe answers some questions about why was Gideon so determined. It's personal with him, which I have to say again is sort of an ambivalent thing. It's understandable. There's no censure of that given. That's not something that he is necessarily judged for, but it's not really a positive thing to think about either, is it? It's not just the man of faith who goes and acts because God has told him to do that. It's a family vendetta. That might be the purpose of giving these kinds of details at the end. Show the fear theme and how Gideon has turned into something else. He no longer resembles what his son is showing. And maybe answer to why this has been so important all along. Not necessarily spiritual stakes, but more, much more personal, much more visceral ones. All right, let's go back then to these Israelite enemies that we have now, beginning in verse 13, and Gideon's going to return to Succoth and Penuel. How would you grade out his performance in this case? And I'll say again from the top, I think there's probably good and bad to be found here. So what do we think with how Gideon deals with the elders and the leaders of these two cities when he comes back on his sort of revenge tour? Can we understand it or say from maybe a spiritual standpoint, they had done what was wrong. They had been faithless. They had not helped Israel. They were only looking out for themselves. Here was God's judge. He had been clothed in the Spirit of the Lord, and they say, we'd love to help, but we're not gonna. Good luck, though. We would look at that and say, they should be punished. They were faithless. We would be able to find good grounds for holding these men accountable. On the other hand, what's their primary crime or the root cause of their primary crime here? They want proof first. Okay, let's think back. Let's think hard about what Gideon's story has been about. Who does that sound like if you're saying, I want proof first, and then I'll help? That's Gideon. That's what he's been doing the whole story. That's what he's been doing from the very beginning. So, it doesn't remove their culpability, but it does make us ask Gideon, couldn't you have shown some mercy? Couldn't you have been a little more understanding of their problem? Because God had to convince you with three different signs. And now they wanted proof before they helped. You were unwilling to do that. Again, a lot of mitigating things there. We'd say, well, they simply didn't help. Gideon was being called to, you know, risk his life and go into battle. That's a little bit of a different thing. But it's the same idea of not holding people accountable and punishing them for something that you yourself were guilty of. To me, very, very similar tones to the parable of the wicked servant that Jesus will tell. Man who has been forgiven a great debt by his master and then goes and finds his fellow servant who owed him a small debt and says, you're going to the torturers unless you pay up. And he's called, you wicked servant. Why have, you know, what were you thinking? You can't possibly be this hypocritical that you would hold him accountable when you are being forgiven a great debt. That's a version of what Gideon is doing here. Steve? Yes.
In the case of something continual, they were fearful, but it was after the fact.
Yeah.
Knowing what God had already done. So
yeah. We could say maybe some proof has already been given. Some good proof has already been given to them in the fact that that huge Midianite army was already not so huge and is running for their lives. So another mitigating factor there that would say, well, they've already had a sign. Yeah, good point. Anything else there? Yeah, Gary.
The thing that gets me about Gideon more than anything else is his acceptance of what God was going to do to him.
Mm-hmm.
The two guys, Ziba and Zalman, thousands of people with he didn't even consider that as being a problem.
Again, if we're looking at good and bad in chapter 8, probably the best, probably the highlight that we can look at in chapter 8 would be the fact that throughout all of this, all that fear is gone. Any of that doubting that he might have had has been replaced with faith, has been replaced with a seemingly unwavering confidence that we are going to finish this, we are going to get our guys, and we are going to drive out the enemy, and that's exactly what happens. That's Hebrews 11 in the history right here, isn't it? That through faith in weakness, they were made strong, and they put to flight the armies of the aliens. I've wondered often if the Hebrews writer was thinking exactly of Gideon when he wrote those words, because that's exactly what he's doing here. He was weak, he was fearful, he becomes strong through his faith and puts to flight these armies of the aliens. Again, that's not to say everything he does here is laudable, but it is definitely to his credit seeing that confidence, that total faith that the victory will be won. All right, yeah, Ron, go ahead. Yeah. Right. It is going to be meted out, I guess we would say, meted out fairly to the extent that only those men who are responsible will end up paying for it. Good detail to remember there. All right, beginning in verse 22, we get an epilogue of sorts to all of this. This will be Gideon's later life. The men of Israel say to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your grandson also, for you've delivered us from the hand of Midian." I don't think, here again, is sort of this mix of good and bad, and feel free to come to your own conclusion on it. A lot of times we look at this as being a sign of Israel's, you know, disobedience and wickedness because they wanted a king, and God will later, you know, sort of discredit them for that, etc. It could as well, though, just simply be if they are functioning out of gratitude for God's servant, and they are just saying, we think that you have done well, we think that you are a good man, and we're willing to submit to your lead. It does seem to have more negative overtones based on how everything will develop kind of from this point on in terms of kingship. But also to mention here, they don't mention an idea of king yet, or at least that specific word is not brought out by them. They say rule over us. At any rate, this is what they want out of Gideon. Now, last time we'll ask this question then, how do we grade Gideon's answer here? How do you like the way he deals with this problem? Okay, well, his statement there in verse 23, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." That's well said, isn't it? We'd have to look at that and say, okay, right on. You came to the only wise conclusion that you could have come to. And at first glance, and you know, just based on what Gideon is saying there, exactly what he should have said, exactly the way things should be. We're not going to have a dynastic rule. We're not going to pass this on through bloodlines. God is our king. We will serve him. Maybe if he wants one of my children to be a guy that he uses, then that'll be the way it goes. But other than that, we don't have human rulers. You just simply listen to the Lord. Okay, sounds good. David. Okay, if the story cut off at verse 23, I'd say, yeah, Gideon did great. He passed this one with flying colors. Unfortunately, it continues on in verse 24. And so we have to weigh what he says against what he does and what it seems like he's kind of thinking here. So at first we've got a refusal. No, it's going to be the Lord who rules over you. But maybe the following verses show us exactly what he means by saying that. How is the Lord going to rule over them? In what form will that take? Throughout the rest, for time's sake, I'll just mention kind of my main premise here throughout to the end of the chapter. There are several markers that would demonstrate here that Gideon is maybe not as averse to the idea of kingship as he sounded. There are going to be several things that sound, in fact, like that's exactly what he was trying to do. He was styling himself, in fact, as a king. The first thing we're going to see is he's going to make this golden ephod, just a priestly garment of some kind. The language isn't clear. I don't know if this is an image, you know, like a solid gold robe or vestment that he makes, or if he made an image and then put an ephod on it, or if it was just a cloth garment that had a lot of gold ornamentation on it. I don't know, and it doesn't say. I don't know that that's especially the point. Whatever is happening here, he is making some kind of visual of or a particular garment. It is very ornate. It is very weighty. It is very expensive. And he is going to set that up in his hometown of Ophrah, and it's going to become a snare. So the first thing Gideon will do is what many kings of this time and place do. They're religious innovators. They are leaders of the cult. They are leaders of the people's worship. And so Gideon determines, here's how we'll do it from now on. There are a lot of awful ironies in this, but especially in the idea of using an ephod itself. First, it is a garment, and it seemed, maybe now we're seeing why God used that phrase when the Spirit of the Lord came upon him back in chapter 7. If you'll remember there, we pointed out that the phrase used there is the only time it's used in the book to say that the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon. He was invested with it. And so he was wearing the Spirit of the Lord like a garment. It was his clothing. Now Gideon makes a different garment. He makes a different piece of clothing, and it's one for false worship. So that's not good. The other idea is that an ephod is part of, as well, Israel had one already. The high priest had one, and he was probably at this point in Shiloh. But one of the main functions that you would have the breastplate, and in the breastplate a pocket or a pouch where you stored the Urim and the Thummim, which you can use to inquire of God, to see yes or no on certain matters. Should we do this? Should we do that? Etc. What's the will of God? That seems to be what Gideon has in mind when he's setting this up here. The Lord will rule over you, and this is how he'll do it. I'll make this ephod. We can then inquire of him, and he can tell us what he wants. And I'll be the one doing that, kind of, is the implication. God said to Gideon when he first appeared to him, I will be with you. And throughout, we saw God talking to Gideon directly. Gideon, if he is faithful to God and is willing to just let that be enough, that God will tell him what he wants, you don't need to make this golden image. You don't need to do a lot of stuff like this. God's going to tell you what you need to know. And if you do need these extra means of divination, these extra means of inquiring of the Lord, go to Shiloh, go to the ark, go to the tabernacle, and inquire of God the way that he's already told you to do so. Oh, I ran out of time right when I didn't want to. We will finish up with this idea next week because it really will play into Abimelech's life as well. Abimelech is just the final awful kind of death rattle of all of this story that will really tell us how Gideon's family ends and thus how this particular story ends. So, be keeping in mind for next week, we're going to look at all of chapter 9. It's a long one. I'll talk fast. We'll be able to finish it. But be keeping in mind these ideas of kingship and rule. Who is going to rule Israel? That's sort of the question in everyone's mind right now. Gideon has said, not me, but God. His behavior might show something different, and his son is absolutely going to have a different answer for that question. So we'll look at all those together next week. Thank you so much. Really do appreciate your time, attention, comments. We'll look forward to getting into chapter 9 next week.